Brembo Red High Performance Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Brembo Red, the world's first high performance podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of the automotive world and into the paddock of the race world to bring you the latest trends and information. And from time to time, we give you some insight into the world's best brake systems and components from Brembo. This episode of Brembo Red is no exception, as we'll be talking to expert car builder and host of Chasing Classic Cars, Wayne Carini. We'll then spend some exclusive time with General Motors chief designer Michael Simcoe, who will explain where car designs are going in what's becoming a very disruptive automotive business. Should be interesting, given the radical changes in design we're seeing in all of GM's vehicles, like the new Chevrolet Corvette with its newly redesigned mid-engine. We'll also introduce you to Ben Pohl, another interesting member of the Brembo team, who explains how Brembo is helping to develop the next generation of passionate automotive engineers. And of course, we wrap up the podcast with an update on the racing and performance world with our in-house racing engineer, Mike Messina. Should be interesting, so I hope you'll stay with us. At the end of July this year, for the ninth year in a row, Brembo was one of the major sponsors of the Concours d'Elegance held in Plymouth, Michigan. This is one of the major car shows held around the country each year, probably the third most impressive car show behind the granddaddy of them all, the Pebble Beach Concours, held in August near Monterey, California, and maybe the Amelia Island Concours held in Florida. These shows are a great opportunity to see spectacular cars you don't normally get to see. Gives us a chance to talk about Brembo and Brembo's brakes, and of course our new aftermarket store, BrembostoreUSA.com, or we just tell people now, go to buybrembo.com. It's just as easy as that. But these shows also give Brembo Red an opportunity to meet with and talk with some great people in the car business, including our first guest here on the podcast, Wayne Carini. Wayne was Grand Marshal at this year's Plymouth, Michigan Concours. You probably know Wayne as the host of Motor Trend's popular TV show, Chasing Classic Cars, which is in its 14th season and is broadcast throughout the world. But to be honest, Wayne was restoring cars for 40 years before he chased classic cars on TV. He's restored cars for celebrities like David Letterman and Yvonne Lendl, and for true car collecting families like the DuPonts, just to name a few. He's really an expert on finding, restoring, and preserving the classics. He isn't a bad driver either. So let's head down to this year's Concours in Plymouth and spend some time with Wayne. Here we are on a beautiful summer Sunday at the Concours d'Elegance in Plymouth, Michigan, with Wayne Carini, and he is the host, obviously, of Chasing Classic Cars, and now he's going to add a new title onto his name, Grand Marshal of the Concours d'Elegance here in Plymouth this year. First of all, congratulations, Wayne, on being the Grand Marshal.
Thank you very much.
You know, hanging out at car shows is not something unusual for you, right? You've been doing it since you were a child, right?
6 months old, I think my father brought me to Greenfield Village to the first Model A Restorers Club meet. So, it's been a lifelong thing with me and my family.
And what about car restoration? That's something that, if it's in anybody's blood, it's in your blood, correct?
You know, my dad restored cars for a living when I was growing up, so it's in my blood for sure. I certainly didn't want to follow in my father's footsteps to do automobile restorations. I'd like to be part of automobiles, but I wanted to be an architect and then an art teacher, graduated art education, and couldn't find the exact job I was looking for. Went back to work for dad, and I took over the business in 1973.
So you do have that art slant in your makeup. You like to be creative.
Yeah, and you know what? It worked out really well. I got a bunch of young guys back in 1973, took over the business and sort of taught them what my father taught me. So that art education sort of followed through.
Let's talk about that a little bit. You know, the younger generation, that's one of the big fears for all of us in the car business right now. Is number one, are they going to want cars? Because it seems like they just want things with heavy-duty electronics and they can put in their pocket. How do you get the young interested in all this stuff that we're excited about?
Well, it's a big concern, of course, because we see young people not even wanting their driver's license when they're 16. They wait until they're 21, usually, to get their driver's license. You know, their social things were with us. We couldn't wait to get our driver's license so we could go hang out with our friends. now you hang out online, or you go to the shopping mall and you hang out. So things have changed, but yet I just give this analogy, you know, when I was growing up, you know, in high school you snuck a beer every once in a while, and then you go to college and you drink shots, and then you grow up and drink fine wine. So things evolve. It's just on a different scale and in a different timeline for these young people. But
I think it'll just take them a little while to get into it.
I do. I really think that I think young people really want to become involved. But what's happened is over the years, concours and car shows have become something that cars are a distance away. So in other words, people say, well, don't get near my car. Don't touch it. And who wants to be involved with something you can't look at and touch and feel? And so we really want people to be able to open their cars up and let young people sit in them and start the engines and do all those things. And the minute that that happens, you get young people hooked. And they'll be car people for the rest of their lives.
See, I agree with you in a lot of ways, because I think you need that tactile approach to it. I mean, they have to hear it, see it, feel it, touch it. And you know what? You can put a lot of electronics. And a lot of the restores that you're doing, are you putting in some of the Bluetooth technology and things like that?
You know, we're more of authentic, right down to the last bolt and nut on the car being exactly as it left the factory. So we don't restomod cars. Our deal is authentic restoration on classic cars or exotics, but what we're looking at right now is making electric motors to power classic cars. And a lot of these cars get driven from the trailer to the show field and back in the trailer. Why not have an electric motor that'll do that for you, where you don't disturb the exact authenticity of the car?
Can you talk about your personal car collection? Tell us what you collect.
People always say, how many cars do you have? The answer is, I have way too many, but never enough. So we never give out numbers, because my wife might find out exactly how many cars we actually own. And my favorite car is the next car. So we're always on the hunt, always on the chase, and that's the exciting part for me is finding new and unearthed treasures. You know, they call me the automobile archaeologist.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of cool to do that. But I like everything with wheels. So I've got brass cars, I've got classic cars. One of my favorite new cars, I just bought a 65 Shelby GT350. I just love that car and the way it drives. And so my collection started turning the corner a little bit, and stuff that I haven't driven within a couple of years, I'm looking at selling and buying cars that I know I'll use. For instance, look around the collection. We've got a 16 Pierce Arrow. I'd love to take my grandson out in it, but my daughter refuses to let him go in the car. He's 3 and a half unless there's a shoulder harness for his car seat and that stuff. Well, not going to put it in the Pierce Arrow. So now, okay, maybe it's time to sell the car. But we'll replace it with something really cool.
All right, every car collector, even though they say they don't have a favorite, there must be one cherished car in that collection.
Well, there's several cherished cars, that's for sure. I love original cars, and so I have a Hudson Italia that's totally original. I have a 54 Studebaker Starliner Coupe that's totally original. It's such a beautiful car. In 1954, you got to figure what Fords and Chevys and Plymouths looked like. And they were boxes. And here's the Studebaker with such beautiful lines, Ray Malawi design. And it just shows you how far ahead Studebaker was. And maybe that was something that really is the reason they failed, is that people couldn't understand the future that they were presenting to them. So, but, you know, original cars are really my favorite. You know, I like stuff that I can drive. We have a 26 Bentley 3-liter touring car that I drive a lot. And that's a lot of fun. I take that on tours, so. It's like asking somebody what's their favorite child. You know, which one is your favorite? Well, that's kind of a tough answer.
Most unusual car in the collection?
Most unusual. The Hudson Italia is very unusual. I just bought a car called the Crosley Nicholas Flying Saucer. So I like names, too. You know, so names of cars are really cool. We have a Spawn, which is a very unusual German-built bodied Cadillac. Very weird-looking car. And sometimes the weirder, the better. I mean, I love cars that nobody else has.
Ferraris, that has a special place in your heart. Why is that?
I grew up loving Ferraris. My father restored classic cars and Model A's, and so Ferraris weren't in his repertoire. And so one day, he used to take me to Luigi Canetti Motors down in Greenwich, and I used to look at all the Ferraris when I was a teenager. And I read Road and Track, and I, you know, watched television for the Formula One races. And then I got the opportunity to fix a 73 Daytona Spider. A gentleman bought it, got it in an accident. I got to know Mr. Canetti, He was impressed about the work that I had done on this Daytona, and next thing you know, there was like five or six Ferraris in our shop being worked on from different people around the country that Mr. Kennedy had recommended to us, and it sort of took off. We restored a really great car of Kennedy, a 365P, which is a center steering car, so it's got three seats. The center steering, center seat is the steering, so it was like driving a Formula One car, just a wide Formula One car down the street. I saw that when I was 14 years old for the first time. Mr. Kennedy asked me to restore it many years ago, and actually we debuted it here in Detroit at Meadowbrook before the St. John's show was called the Meadowbrook Show, and we debuted it there. So it was a very cool car.
So in all this restoration, I think you've put your hands on some Brembos from time to time.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and people say, what's the most important aspect of a car? You know, is aesthetics or whatever? I said, well, no, it's making it go, but the most important part is making it stop. You can go as fast as you want, but you have to stop.
What about the aesthetics? You have a lot of customers that come in and they're talking about brakes for their cars and things. It is a big thing, isn't it?
It is. And the newer the cars, of course, you know, the more flashy the brakes are now, and they're all different colors, and it's really brought brakes to a new height in car manufacturing as well as in restoration. So, and everybody wants their car to have a little bit different. So now that the wheels are going black, it really makes those brakes pop on a car. And I saw a guy yesterday, and I can't remember what kind of car. I think it was a Lamborghini, and they were bright fluorescent green, you know, and he had a green shirt on when he was driving it. So the brakes were the most important part of the car, apparently.
When you think back at your days in architectural school, did you ever think you'd be here right now?
No, you know, I grew up on a farm, and so my father restored cars in the cow barn on the farm. Driving tractors at 9 and 10 years old, that was pretty cool. So all along your life, things are really good at the point of your life that you're living. And so I never thought too much of the future. I lived for the day that I was in, and I think that's important to do, although it's good to look for the future. But I'm so lucky. But luck is preparation meeting opportunity. That's the meaning of luck to me. You know, if you're prepared, somebody opens the door crack. So I was given the opportunity to do a TV show, and I said yes because I thought I was confident enough to maybe do it. And it all happened because of an article in the New York Times written about me of a car that I'd chased since I was 16. I bought it when I was 52. And Donald Osborne wrote that story, and it appeared in the New York Times. And Jim Ostrowski, the head of my production company, called me on Monday and said, I'd like to do a television show about you. And I said, for what? What did you see? And he says, I read the New York Times article. I'm looking for automotive content to do for Discovery Channel, and I'd like to talk to you. We talked for a half an hour at my office. He got the camera out of the car. And here I am today, 14 seasons later or years later, and over 200 episodes. We're in 47 countries now around the world. It's amazing. Yeah, it is amazing.
Wayne, it's a pleasure to have you, not just because you're a TV host and you're Grand Marshal now. I think what I admire most about you is your passion for autos. And really, it's not only history, but it's the future for us. But thanks for being with us on the podcast.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
This is Brembo Red. We're going to stay right here in Plymouth, Michigan at this year's Concours d'Elegance. And we'll be joined by GM's chief designer, Michael Simcoe, right after this.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Brembo Red with your host, Dan Sandberg.
We're back at the Concours d'Elegance in Plymouth, Michigan, and it is indeed my pleasure to welcome the Vice President of GM Global Design, Michael Simcoe. Welcome to the Brembo Podcast.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
You know, you are the seventh Vice President of Global Design that GM has had, and I think for some of our audience, they may say, well, okay, well, why is that a big deal? Well, that is seven designers, head designers in the company over the last 110 years.
Yeah,
that's not a lot of designers.
Pretty amazing. And it's I see it as an incredible privilege. The best thing about it is I deal with a group of very, very creative designers and engineers every day, and that's the reward. And I see my role as enabling their creativity and their strength. And you can see it in the vehicle that we launched only a week ago, the new Corvette. The mid-engine Corvette, the Stingray, is a wonderful vehicle, and it represents the sort of power and the passion that exists inside GM design at the moment.
Is it personally an overwhelming thing for you as an individual to have a job like this?
Well, when I started out, I never had this as a goal. I've been very fortunate to work with some great leaders over the years, and Ed Welburn and I had a wonderful relationship, and when he helped nominate me, I was very proud.
Do you feel a pressure that you're making a mark in history? Because GM is a historical company, there's no doubt about it. It's a huge company to begin with, yeah. But it's a part of automotive history, really.
Yeah, it was explained to me in no uncertain terms that these were big shoes to fill. But it's a great time to be in this role because, as you'd know, the industry is changing in every aspect. And one of the biggest ones right now is as we move, as designers contemplate moving into the electrification of vehicles and also autonomous vehicles. But as the industry changes, designers have to think differently about the business, and therefore I have to think differently about how to guide them.
You know, I talk about electrification a lot on this podcast, and I mean, you read the papers, that's all you hear about.
Yeah.
In your philosophy, does an electric car look different than the cars that we're driving right now?
The biggest thing we've found is that the packaging, the way the architecture is put together is quite different. You know, clearly there's some things you don't have in an IC vehicle, but you replace them with a very large battery. It's making for different proportions, but we don't believe customers anymore are simply looking for or really looking for vehicles that scream I'm electric and therefore have the different almost science project appearance. Most of our customers tell us that we'll buy an electric vehicle if it does everything that my gas powered vehicle does, including in some ways the appearance.
You know, when you design a vehicle, particularly a global vehicle, because that's all we hear about, that's how you're going to get that leverage, if you will, on cost and be able to design something. Are you designing it for an American, an Australian, a European, a German, or are we all just car people and you can design a car? How do you go about that?
I think in the past, there were differences in how the different studios, certainly in GM globally, handled design. I mean, the customer preferences were different back then, but in the age of sort of instant gratification, everyone sees it, whether it's a what you might call a developing country or a developed country like North America or European markets, everyone is seeing a vehicle launch at the same time or within seconds because it's all on the net, and so in some ways that's flattened or leveled expectations, and in some ways it gives a right for a developing market to have a customer there to have all the desires and all the wants of a developed country now. I mean, why shouldn't someone in a developing country want the same level of trim, the same level of feature content? And that's what the net's brought to it. You know, design is not quite ubiquitous because there are still, particularly in color and trim, there are differences, but essentially the desires of customers are the same.
So because we've homogenated, if you will, our tastes globally.
Well, it's if you like, car design and or vehicles have reacted, I suppose, to the net in exactly the same way as every other product.
Let's talk about that shift from SUVs to sedans. I look at your history, and I see that you were involved in several big sedans, nice sedans, actually, that the GM company had come out with. How do you feel about this shift?
I have a love for large performance sedans. That's my background, but then you know, I've grown up in the industry through those large vehicles. I've worked in Asia. I've experienced the lots of small sedans and hatches as well. And here in North America, now ubiquitous around the world, SUVs are king. But I think what you're seeing is a shift to, I guess, SUVQs or more formal SUVQs being applied to lower seating positions in vehicles. So, and that's where this new term CV is coming from. The trouble is the market is mixing both appearance and content so hard these days, it's very hard to tell what is a true SUV versus what is a CUV or generally a crossover vehicle.
You know, we like to say CUVs are just tall sedans.
Yeah, yeah. When hatches and sedans stop selling, CUVs take their place. But I think there'll be a cycle in the industry, and I think, again, we go back to electrification. Electrification will make people think differently. The bottom line is customers, they want something that says something about them. They like well-styled vehicles. They like things that are premium by nature. They want to park something in their driveway that their neighbours admire. So reason for purchase is the same as it's always been. I think we'll cycle back down to lower vehicles, and essentially everything will be on the road.
Is it difficult making a 7-seater or a 5-seater SUV look different than everybody else's 7- or 5-seater?
I think it was when we were all trying to style small trucks and call them SUVs. I think what's happening though, and this is the fine line between lower CUVs and SUVs in the true sense. Because all the SUVs are to make them, if you like, better styled or well styled, they're getting sleeker. They're getting their center line, if you like, the center line, the profile of the vehicle and proportion is more sporting. They're no longer traditional trucks, and that's what customers are looking for. And I think that signals a trend back down to sleeker and sleeker and more emotional vehicles rather than the upright SUVs. There'll always be a place for function and therefore the upright vehicles, but there's a growing trend towards sexier, lower SUVs.
Speaking of sexier and lower, let's get into the corner of the vehicle,
yes,
since
sir.
This is the Brembo podcast. You know, I worked in the wheel business a long time ago with Hayes Lemmerts, which is a big wheel company. Now I'm in the brake business, and one of the beliefs we always had and we always talked about, particularly our designers of wheels and of course our designers for brakes, is this thing that we always heard about, that the wheel, the corner of the vehicle, was one of the key design features. It was one of those things that the consumer immediately sees when he looks at a vehicle. Is that truth or is that a myth?
No, absolute truth. And the any designer you'll talk to will talk about how to make a vehicle look good, and it's lower, longer, wider, and you add to that larger diameter wheel and tire. Realistically, maybe a customer can't tell you exactly what they're seeing as a well-proportioned vehicle, but behind it will be a larger diameter wheel and tire, and that's what designers are looking for all the time. Where we are today now, an 18-inch wheel is a small wheel.
All right, let me ask you this question, getting into the scoop, because I have to have some scoop now.
24 and 26.
That's where we're headed?
Absolutely.
Okay, so bigger wheels.
Yeah.
Are the wheels going to be open as they are now, or are they going to be more closed?
The wheels styled to suit the style of the vehicle itself. So, I mean, pretty much anything goes. Clearly, as we brand vehicles, we use different style on the wheels too. I'll give a shout-out to Brembo here. Another thing that we're doing more and more these days is thinking about the brake package as well, and the appearance of the brake package, because it is part of that corner. And you guys have done a lot of work for us with colours and the style of the brake and turning the brake, which used to be just a functional item, into a part of the styled vehicle, which is pretty cool. And designers are looking for that now.
Well, I know this is a very difficult job for both of us today, to sit out in a Sunday looking at beautiful vehicles and talking about cars. But nonetheless, I really appreciate you taking some time, stopping by the Brembo booth, being on Brembo Red and our internal podcast. And thank you for being a customer. We really appreciate your passion for autos and of course, Brembo.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great relationship. And apart from sitting here with a tie on in 90 degrees, I'm very happy to be here and I've talked to you.
But you look good anyway. From a design perspective.
Thank you, sir.
You're listening to Brembo Red. Next up, we'll sit down with Ben Pohl, Senior Program Manager for Brembo North America, who'll explain to us how Brembo finds that passionate young talent every company is looking for these days, and even better, the best brake engineers on the planet. That secret revealed right after this short break.
This is Brembo Red.
Hey, it's me, your cell phone. We need to talk about something serious. I know you love me, I know you like using me wherever you are, but I feel like this isn't working out when you're driving. I know you may think that it's possible to focus both on me and the road, but I just don't feel the same way. I think we should spend time away from each other when you're driving. It's for the best.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org, a message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Brembo Red. In each of our podcasts, we like to give our listeners some exposure to the people who are Brembo. Obviously, we love the products and technology that we provide to our customers, but what makes Brembo unique is our people, who have a real passion for the automotive business, technology, and, of course, brakes. One of those people is Ben Pohl, Senior Program Manager at Brembo North America. Welcome, Ben, to Brembo Red.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Now, you are one of the original, or at least early members, of the Brembo team here in North America.
That's true. Not the original. Brembo, as an entity, existed in North America. It had a small office in California and another one in North Carolina doing some aftermarket and high performance and racing stuff. But in the original equipment world, the office that was servicing the manufacturers here in Detroit, it was a very small office when I joined. I came to Brembo in 2003 after a short stint at Ford Motor Company, where I was working on the Ford GT, which had Brembo brakes. And I met the guys in the office, and they offered me the opportunity to come work for them. And I came in. There were only three people at the time. It was a really, really small group, but it was really exciting because we were really building the foundation of the original equipment group here in North America.
And you've seen a lot of changes over the last 10 or 12 years.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, that office was 1,500 square feet. It had a single bay garage. It had just a couple cubicles and a one CAD workstation. Things changed a lot in 2008 when Brembo acquired the Hayes Limmers Disc Company and really created the footprint for what Brembo North America is today, where we're now manufacturing a huge quantity of discs and brake calipers all over North America.
So what do you do each day at Brembo? What does a program manager do?
A program manager is sort of a jack of all trades, but master of none. I'm responsible for overseeing a number of different functions in Brembo, functions that don't necessarily report to me, but I have to make sure that they understand what their role is in the larger task of designing, developing, and manufacturing a product for one of our customers. So the engineers need to understand when the designs need to be done, so the process engineering guys, the technology guys, can make the tooling to produce it, and then the plant needs to know when they need to make those parts to deliver to the customer on time so the customer can build their vehicles.
I mean, you're bringing all of these functions that are all have separate tasks to do with regard to every single program that we manage. You're bringing all those tasks together, right?
That's true. I mean, there's so many things you have to coordinate, and they all have to come together at the right time to hit those launch dates because our customers, they know when the cars are going to hit for every model year, and we have to be on time and support that.
And you've worked on some pretty exciting programs, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. The last 15 years have been a number of good ones. I think probably the one that's closest to my heart, because I worked on it before I came to Brembo, was the Ford GT. That was really exciting. It was really the first mid-engine car that Ford had done in a production context. It was the car that Ford was doing to show off their 100th anniversary. And it was a really small Skunk Works team that was developing the car. So when I came to Brembo, it was neat to continue that experience that I was doing at Ford here on the Brembo side and help make that car successful.
Actually, I was at a golf course over the weekend with Jim O'Connor, who's at used to be the head of Ford.
Sure.
Jim and I were talking, and I said, you know, probably one of the biggest accomplishments I've seen at Ford over the last, you know, I don't know, maybe the last decade was how they kept the Ford GT secret.
You know, the way they approached the one that just came out, or I guess a couple years ago now, was a lot different than the way they approached it when I was working on the 2005 version. In 2005, in the lead up to that car coming to market, they were showing it to the media all the time. They let the media drive the prototypes, and they were doing all kinds of sneak peeks, and they really wanted to keep the interest going for the 2 years during the development process. On this one, as you said, they kept it secret, and then boom, it came to the market, and it really shocked everybody, and it's been an amazing car.
And the press was totally surprised, which is so rare that you don't see previews, and you had no idea what was going on.
There's another car like that that just came out recently that I think we've been talking about a lot, which is the new Chevrolet Corvette for model year 2020. There was a lot of speculation about what that car would be. I mean, we knew that we were coming up on this new product cycle for the Corvette. But the big surprise, of course, is it's a mid-engine car, which is the first time the Corvette has been mid-engine. And I think there's been a ton of excitement about that and the performance potential that it opens up for Chevrolet. And Brembo's supporting that car, and we're very proud to be a part of that car.
Lots of colors of Brembo that are available on that car, isn't there?
That's true. You know, Brembo, in addition to being a very good technical product, has an aesthetic component to it. It's a part of the styling of the car. For many years, we've offered our European customers this opportunity to have multiple colors. You know, we've got the red, the yellow, the orange, we've got the whole rainbow. And Chevrolet wants to offer the same thing on the Corvette, and there are four colors available in the Corvette.
So Brembo was not your first venture into automotive. As you said, you were with Ford Motor Company. But when I look at your career history, you go way back. I mean, you were a car guy when you probably were driving the little cars, right?
Yeah, you know, my interest in cars started when I was a teenager. When I was approaching the age when I was going to drive, I took a real interest in what cars were out there. My dad at the time had a Mazda Miata, and he handed that down to me when I got to drive. And I think it was a great car to start off my driving experience because it was a lot of fun. You know, it's small, it's light, it's got great vehicle dynamics, and it got me excited in cars from that moment. I went on to get an Acura Integra and got into the tuning crowd with that, kind of the Fast and Furious before there was a Fast and Furious, and really found it rewarding to get my hands dirty and work on cars myself. As I went into the university environment, I found a really interesting program when I was in college called Formula SAE. Formula SAE is the world's biggest engineering competition, and what it is the students design, build, and compete with a small, open-wheel, single-seater race car powered by a motorcycle engine. It's a tremendously fun project, and it's very challenging, because when you're in engineering school or business school, and you're doing Formula SAE on the side, there's a lot of work to do. Consider that you have to design the part, you have to make the part yourself, you have to make sure it integrates with the rest of the team, you have to do it on a budget, you have to do it on a timetable. It was kind of like program management light. A lot of people join the program thinking they're going to drive the car and that's the fun part, but it turns out the fun part is actually the project itself, right? And getting to that point where you can go out and compete with other universities. So I did that for about 3 or 4 years at the university, and that experience helped me get the job at Ford Motor Company. When I went to Ford and interviewed for the first time, it wasn't just, here's my grades, can I have a job? It was, here's this thing I've done, this amazing project that challenged me in many, many aspects of the engineering world. And it was a shoo-in. It got me the opportunity at Ford, and then it actually got me the opportunity on the Ford GT program because there were other Formula SAE guys where we knew the secret handshake, and they asked me to be a part of it.
There is a secret handshake?
There's not a secret handshake, but we know who we are. So here at Brembo, I've taken that experience, and I've realized that these are the engineers of the future for the automotive industry, and it's good to give back. So Brembo continues to support the Formula SAE program. We're in contact with about 15 or 20 teams a year that we offer technical advice on how to integrate the brakes into their car, and we offer product for them as well so they can get those cars to maximum performance potential.
You know, we hear a lot about today's younger generation and how they're not into cars and you know, the automotive industry may be in jeopardy because of that. With your experience dealing with all of these kids in college who are really into cars, what's your perspective on that?
You know, I've heard the same thing that some of these younger kids today, they're more interested in Ubering or Lyfting to where they're going, and they're not interested. But that may be true of a small subset. But as you said, the people that I'm involved with, the youth from Formula SAE and other programs, are really interested in cars, right? They're excited about it. And these are the people that are going to help design the cars of the future. This is the challenge for our industry, is how to engage this new generation and offer them cars that keep them excited, right? I mean, they have to be affordable for one. I mean, we can't price the cars out of their reach, so they can't get into them in the first place. They have to be styled well. There's an aesthetic component to a car, an emotional component to buying a car, so they still have to look good. And I think Brembo can help with that. And then they have to be fun to drive, right? They have to have good vehicle dynamics, you know, ride, handling, steering, and braking. And again, that's something Brembo can offer value. And we're still seeing cars in the market that try to appeal to that group. Look at the new Honda Civic Type R. Look at the Ford Focus RS. I mean, these are cars that are affordable and fun and show what performance and vehicle dynamics can feel like.
And at the end of the day, I think, you know, we've ended up using that as sort of a source for some new employees here at Brembo.
Sure. When I go to the Formula SE competitions, there's a lot of companies out there recruiting these engineers, and Brembo's done the same thing. We hired a very talented engineer named Cloyd Reed a couple years ago from the University of Akron, and Cloyd has turned out to be a fantastic hire for the Brembo company. And in fact, he's now in Italy training with the home office.
Well, that's all about passion, I think. When you get people who love cars, love the components that go into those cars, and love Brembo, they're a natural fit for our company.
Yeah, how could you not be passionate about what we do?
Well, thanks, Ben, for joining us on the podcast. I think everyone appreciates all the hard work you do here. Our customers, I know, appreciate it. And, of course, we appreciate you spending some time with us talking about your career and Brembo.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
This is Brembo Red. We'll be right back in just a couple minutes with an update on the racing and performance world.
Stay with us.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
It's time for the racing update here on Brembo Red.
And welcome back to Brembo Red. We're here with Mike Messina.
Wait a second. Was that David Hobbs?
That was David Hobbs. That was a little surprise for you. How did you like that?
Thank you, David. I appreciate that. That's not every day it gets thrown to you from David Hobbs.
Well, David Hobbs, for those of you who are not pure racing fans, would recognize him. That is the voice of F1. And, of course, he was quite a F1 racer himself, wasn't he?
The guy's got a storied past. He's been around since some of the earliest evolution of it. He's one of the few that's seen it all.
So this is Mike Messina, who is the racing manager at Brembo North America, for the quick racing update. So you want to start with NASCAR, and let's do that.
Let's start with NASCAR. Big news since our last update in NASCAR has been Hendrick Motorsports is really sort of finding their way. They're coming back. They're making a strong push this year, and they're doing really well, and it's making all of us really happy to see that. First out of the gate would be Alex Bowman, who won the first cup race of his career at Chicago, which is an intermediate track. This was really cool, too, because Alex went on a string earlier in the year, finishing second 3 weeks in a row, literally three races in a row, Talladega, Dover, Kansas. He was second place in all of them. You know, you have this guy's battling for the win, and he's just coming up short each time, and he hasn't won his first cup race yet. And I don't know if that's exciting or frustrating. It's probably equal parts of both. But to see him finally knock one down and pull that off was really great.
Very dramatic, I think.
Very dramatic. It locks him into the playoffs now. So he's guaranteed a spot in the playoffs, along with Chase Elliott, who's won two races this year. Ironically, the first race that Chase Elliott won this year was at Talladega, to which was also Alex's first second place. And then Chase has also won more recently at Watkins Glen, which was a total gunfight too. So they're both locked in. Hendrick's looking pretty strong. You know, they've also got William Byron, the 24 car. He's not locked in the playoffs, but he's in the top 16, and he's running pretty consistently fast everywhere he's going. And really just kind of leaves us with Jimmy Johnson, who right now is outside the top 16 technically, with just a couple of races to go before the playoffs start.
What about Jimmy Johnson? I mean, there's all this back and forth going on about whether he's going to make it or not make it. He's a 7-time champion. Am I right on that?
Depending on who you ask, you know, everybody's an expert. You know, you got the guys that say that he's not going to be able to pull it off because he hasn't done it yet. And then there's other guys that say, oh yeah, he can, you know, he could still eke one out, but you know, maybe these aren't strong tracks for him. Personally, the guy is, like you said, he's a 7-time champion, and I don't know how you rule him out of anything.
And we had a little bit of a scare, didn't we, in NASCAR?
To put it lightly, yeah. I think everybody by now knows you had Dale Earnhardt Jr. was involved in a plane crash going into Bristol last month, landing in the airport, rough landing, plane pitches one way, then the other, ends up sliding through a fence, catching on fire, and somehow, by some miracle, everybody gets off with just a couple of scratches here and there. Somehow everybody gets off the plane safely.
You know, you never like to see a crash like that, even in a race, obviously, but it's great to see everybody walk off of that with no casualties. Really great.
It is. I mean, it's one thing to see a driver crash his car at a track, but it's another thing to see a driver crash with his whole family and dog included, and it's pretty much a miracle.
Let's jump over to the sports car circuit, 24-hour Le Mans. A lot of drama there this month, huh?
A lot of drama at Le Mans. So, you know, the short version is that Toyota won with their hybrid, their LMP1 overall, which was great. You know, strong team, hard to beat. You almost had to expect it, I think, going into this year. Really, the drama came in the GT AM category of this race. So you had Ben Keating was there with the Ford GT. And this is a Pro-Am category. And he goes there with Riley supporting him, Riley Motorsports, who previously fielded Vipers, and they've got a lot of experience there. They go out and call it Davy and Goliath, call it Cinderella, call it what you want, but they go out and they win the class. Then shortly thereafter get disqualified. And they got disqualified because In FIA racing and in sports car racing at the pro level, you have restrictions on refueling. So in other words, how quickly you're allowed to refuel your car, there's a time limit. And then you also have a fuel capacity restriction. They were dinged for refueling too quickly by 0.6 seconds. And in terms of fuel capacity, they were over by 0.25 cups on a 25-gallon tank, and that was enough to disqualify him and hand the win to the second-place Porsche team. That's racing is, it's got rules for a reason, and that's how that unfolded. So a lot of drama surrounding that.
So the cup runneth over is not a good thing in IMSA.
No matter. It's not allowed to runneth over by no amount.
How about IMSA?
In IMSA, there's some good stories with Mazda in the DPI category. Mazda has been racing prototypes for several years now, and they've just kind of stuck to it. This is a great group, nice guys, working hard. And they pulled one out. They won the six-hour Watkins Glen race. And you think, oh, okay, flash in the pan. But they went the next week to Mossport and won the Canadian Tire race, the next week in a row. Then they got BOP'd, which means that, there's regulations and no good deed goes unpunished. So you get more weight or less power, whatever. They got a little bit more weight thrown onto them. And some people said, okay, well, that's the end of that. And then they went to Road America and won that race too. So it's just great to see them, finally having the kind of success that they deserve.
That's what you look for in racing, right? Sort of this comeback week after week, right? A little bit of adversity, and then they turn around and they come back and win it.
You do, and you expect the series to have the ingredients so that something like that can actually happen. And when it really does, it's just a thrill. And everybody up and down that paddock is really happy to see Mazda make that happen.
Can you give us the standings right now in IMSA?
In IMSA and Prototype, it's Penske Acuras leading in DPI, followed by Cadillac, and then Mazda. In GTLM, in the top category of GT, you've got Porsche running 1-2 with Ford in third in their final year of competition. And then in the GTD category, you've got Acura with the NSX, which is really cool to see that happening. They're leading that with BMW chasing them and Porsche in third spot.
Let's jump over to off-road. What happened there?
Pretty sure we won the Baja 500 with Andy McMillan. He's been with us for over 10 years now. We've been on a lot of Andy's trucks. Led that race from the pole, was never passed for 487 miles. He did not relinquish first place, so great win.
The big guys, Formula One, what's going on over there?
The story hasn't changed a whole lot. It's Mercedes, more Mercedes, and they're just leading. They're leading the championship 1-2, and they're being chased by Red Bull, who's having a pretty good year for largely being considered something of an underdog, I guess, if there's such a thing as an underdog F1 team. And that continues to be another knife fight.
Well, Mike, thanks for joining us here from Virginia International Raceway. I was waiting for an engine to rev up right outside here, the garage, but it didn't happen. So I guess we got lucky this time.
We did this time.
We'll see you at the end of the year at the next Brembo Red episode, and you'll give us an update on all of the year's standings in 2019.
Sounds like a plan. I appreciate it, Dan.
So that's going to be it for Brembo Red this month. Thanks to all of our guests for joining us this month on the podcast, and to each of you for spending some time with us here on Brembo Red. Remember, if you have any questions, suggestions, or comments on this podcast, please feel free to send them to us here at Brembo by sending an email to podcast@us.brembo.com. Or feel free to leave your comments where you downloaded this podcast. We'll see you soon on another episode of Brembo Red. For now, this is Dan Sandberg from Brembo North America. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Brembo Red with your host, Dan Sandberg. Send your comments, questions, and suggestions to podcast@us.brembo.com. Brembo Red is produced and copyrighted by Brembo North America.